This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Medical News Network and California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Evan Snyder, who is a professor at the Burnham Institute in San Diego and the director of their Stem Cell Research Institute. Is the Burnham in San Diego or La Jolla, or where exactly?
It's actually in La Jolla.
In La Jolla, okay. Well, welcome back to Utopia Media.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
What I wanted to talk about was the current controversy swirling around the South Korean stem cell research and what implications it might have for similar efforts in the U.S. and particularly in California. What's your latest understanding of what the latest controversial developments are in that issue?
Well, as you can imagine, this is a moving target, and it seems that new information comes out literally every day. I guess the initial furor emerged probably about a month ago.
Of course, before that, the initial announcements created quite a stir themselves, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, the initial announcement created a stir because it was a technical feat to be able to literally do in practice what had only been talked about theoretically, and that's being able to take a nucleus from a skin cell, for example, and put it into an unfertilized egg, have that egg start dividing, create what we call a blastocyst after, you know, maybe 5 or 6 days, and then pull out a part of that blastocyst that then gives rise to stem cells, to human embryonic stem cells. And the thing that was exciting was not only that one could actually do this with human cells. Up to this point, it had been done with mice, dogs, sheep, cats, but it had never really been able to be done with humans. But in the paper that was published back in 2005 in Science in June, they were able to take a nucleus from a theoretically prospective transplant recipient and find that the lines actually matched this potential recipient identically. In other words, it would have been a perfectly matched cell that you could do a transplant with and therefore avoid potential rejection.
And the people that was taken, the nuclei were taken from, were potential patients with spinal cord injuries,
right,
or degenerative diseases.
Right. So, of course, this was proof of concept that what had been talked about as the virtue and the value of nuclear transfer could actually happen. So, again, in 2004, when they first showed that one could actually do this, and then in 2005, when they showed that it could even be done in a patient-specific manner, it created a lot of excitement. And they were able to accomplish this because they just work so hard at it. It really comes down to not being biology, but really a technical tour de force, which requires trial and error, many, many people, many, many man hours of work. So most
and specify for our audience who the they that we're talking about here is.
The they would be the Korean research group of Dr. Wong.
Okay.
And, you know, very interestingly, in that country, as opposed to what goes on here, the government has been entirely behind these efforts. And so they've provided space, resources, money, and a lot of enormous emotional support. And this work is very, very labor-intensive.
And apparently Dr. Hwang is quite the rock star over there in Korea these days.
Yeah,
he's
become about as close to a rock star as a scientist can probably become.
Right.
And what most non-Korean scientists working in the stem cell field realized was that probably the most efficient way to be able to start exploiting this kind of technique is to not to try to reinvent the wheel, but to do what scientists do, which is to pool one's resources and talents and collaborate with somebody who's already worked out the technical hurdles.
Well, how has that worked out in this specific instance? Have you and other stem cell researchers in the U.S. been able to access the techniques that the South Koreans used, or did you already have access to them and they just were more industrious in applying them?
No, you know, I think that the reason they were able to make advances more quickly than anybody else in any other country, including in the States, is that they had support. In other words, he had a huge number of workers paid by the government and using space supported by the government. So when you have a technical hurdle like this, it has more to do with just putting in the man hours than anything else.
I read several reports that that this work was done for $200,000. Is that true, or from what you say, it sounds like it was a lot more than that?
Well, it's hard to know. It's hard to put a dollar amount on labor because the going wage in Asia is probably different than in the United States. There's different requirements, I think, and we're not thinking so much in terms of dollars, but just mostly in terms of man hours, and then just being able to work out all of the bugs. I think right now the rest of the scientists were just in the stage of figuring out how one might be able to collaborate with Dr. Wong. So a lot of these negotiations and discussions were just in their very earliest stages, and everybody was doing an enormous amount of due diligence. In other words, what would the ground rules be? Where would the work be done? Who would do the work?
Two other things. Can you say what the Burnham Institute's relationship to this research has been, or up until now?
Actually, no relationship at all, other than negotiating a potential collaboration. Because again, we have a very, very active and forward-moving stem cell program.
You're pursuing some of these same goals as they achieved. That's right, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. Sure. And less so for trying to do transplantation with these cells, and more trying to make stem cell lines that can model human diseases for which no good models exist, so that we can test drugs against them, and also figure out exactly how the diseases begin to unfold.
For example, something that was called motor neuron disease in the UK and Lou Gehrig's disease in the US, that kind of...
Some of these diseases have very, very poor models. The mice really just don't mimic the real human disease, and sometimes you just need to have diseased human cells in a dish. It becomes a real problem if you don't even know what's causing the disease. So this may have been a way of doing it, and that's what we are most interested in doing.
Were the South Korean achievements, or what, and we're going to talk about whether they really were achievements, important from the point of view of intellectual property as well? Were there reported to be new patentable techniques that were developed to do the process that U.S. firms, California firms, would need to have licensed, or hadn't the discussions reached that point yet? Or what can you say about the intellectual property in the Korean discoveries, if they were?
Yeah, the intellectual property picture is a bit of a mess, and it's exceedingly controversial. There are many people who claim various kinds of patents, and one of the interesting things is, as you probably know, is that in Europe, and probably in Asia, though I can't comment to that particularly, one cannot patent biologic material. So patents that are prevalent in the United States do not hold water in Europe or in other parts of the world.
What about processes?
Well, same kind of debate. So, to tell you the truth, we had never really gotten into that kind of discussion.
Okay.
I think we were purely now talking scientifically.
Okay.
And as I said, we're getting to the point of due diligence. The one thing we knew that we were going to, whatever work would be done going forward, that we would hold everybody to standards of biomedical research as they exist in the United States.
Which is, generally speaking?
Well, in particular, it would come down to what about egg donation, since that probably is the rate-limiting factor in any of this research.
Okay, well, I was about to raise that on the ethical and administrative grounds. Could you give us a little background on the importance of egg donation in the entire stem cell research enterprise?
Well, in the entire stem cell research enterprise, it's actually very unimportant.
Oh.
It actually, everything that we're actually talking about, quite interestingly,
right?
Nuclear transfer, making cell lines from the transfer of a nucleus to an unfertilized egg
right.
is just one very, very small aspect of the whole stem cell field, and one that might not even be that important.
It was pretty important in Proposition 71's campaign, wasn't it?
Well, not really.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think the opponents seized upon it because it seemed to be an emotional hot-button issue. But even in Prop 71, it was a trivial little part. What scientists don't like to do is to know that certain techniques are excluded from being available to them.
Right.
Because in science, you never know what you're going to need to do.
Right.
So the argument there was not so much that this is the most important aspect of stem cell biology, but simply that we may need that. It shouldn't be off limits to us.
Well, as far as I understand it, and based on also what you've just said a few minutes ago, the two ways in which stem cell research can lead to cures or treatments or cures is in elucidating the disease process and the process by which various treatments could be used against that process, which can be done essentially in vitro instead of in vivo, and can be done faster, cheaper, and with less damage to the experimental subjects. Is that fair? That's one main way. That's
so one technique. One use certainly
right.
is as a model of disease to help you understand
right.
the disease better.
And the other way is what essentially we've been talking about in terms of the South Koreans, which is the production of differentiated nerve, heart, pancreatic cells through the process of that we've just been talking about to treat directly the patients for those degenerative diseases.
That's not correct. That's confusing two separate things. So I would say
I'm saying those are two separate ways in which embryonic stem cell research can lead to treatments or cures. Is that
or not? Yeah, though from that second
right.
The Koreans would not have contributed significantly to that advance.
Is that right? I thought right. that's what the essence of their contribution was.
No.
Why is that?
So let's go back to the distinction you made.
Right.
The two very important uses of stem cell biology
right.
in a very simple-minded way are, one, to understand what's going on in disease and mechanisms.
Right.
Two, to actually treat them.
Okay.
In understanding them, you can probably get away with just cells in a dish against which you can test drugs and understand mechanisms.
And do those require much in the way of egg donations to generate them?
Well, that may be one way of doing it.
Okay.
It's not the only way of doing it.
Okay.
In the second technique, where you take cells and you transplant them,
right.
that probably does not involve unfertilized eggs or nuclear transfer. What you simply need is any stem cell line that you can then use as graft material. And the overwhelming majority of stem cell lines have come from leftover blastocysts or embryos a few days after fertilization that are meant to be discarded after in vitro fertilization therapies have been done.
Right. No, I understood that, but I also understood that the stem cells generated from the excess blastocysts / embryos were not necessarily suitable for patients because of the immune response, and that it was the function of using eggs and cells from the patients, nuclei from the patients, that would generate stem cells that wouldn't be reacted against by the immune system. And that was the point of being able to create individualized stem cells. But you're more of an expert than I am. Please correct me or fill in the gaps there on that issue.
Right. So when you decide, now I am going to take cells and transplant them
right.
into a recipient,
right.
there are a number of things that you need to take into account. One, do we know where to transplant them? Do
right.
we know what kind of cells to put in?
Have we differentiated them completely?
Have we differentiated them into the right cells?
Right.
Do we know even what to replace and what to fix?
Right.
And then one other aspect in there is, will these cells be tolerated by the recipient?
Right.
And that's an open question. What we're starting to learn is that the stem cells themselves may be actually more tolerated than we ever imagined. They may not actually be rejected. And the immune stem cells may be so immature that they actually do not have the recognition molecules on their surface
right.
that cause a rejection.
So they're essentially blank slates for the immune system of the recipient.
Potentially.
Potentially.
And we've done an enormous amount of work, for example, using mouse stem cells that have become nerve cells.
Right.
And when we take mouse cells into another mouse, we never get rejection, and we never use immunosuppression. When we cross boundaries, as you have to do experimentally, which is artificial, but, you know, obviously one needs to do that experimentally, then we simply use immunosuppression.
Which kind of boundaries are you talking about? Species boundaries?
Yes, species boundaries, correct. Then we will use immunosuppression, but it's even debated how long you need to do immunosuppression. So one technique could be that we simply use the stem cell lines as they exist now and transplant them and maybe do some transient immunosuppression if necessary at all.
So what you're saying, and this is actually news to me, that the stem cells and the specific types of stem cells, nerve or pancreatic or heart muscle, that could be developed from excess embryos from the blastocysts there, are possibly eligible, functional, will work to perform the regenerative functions that have been touted for stem cells, without necessarily running into the kind of immune response that I thought was making necessary and crucial to the whole process, the use of individual eggs and cells from the patient donors to generate non-immune response eliciting stem cells for transplantation. Is that what you've said?
Correct. It's an area that needs more investigation.
Okay.
So understanding a whole new field in stem cell biology
right.
is understanding the interaction between stem cells and the immune system.
Right.
And not only is this a very quickly evolving field, but there's a lot of surprises in store. But there still is, as you mentioned, the theoretical possibility that despite our best efforts, or maybe for certain organs or certain diseases or certain ages, that you really do just need cells that are better matched to the patient.
And those better matched cells would require essentially one egg for each treated patient, at least.
And in that situation, then you really may need to go through this procedure of saying, here's my patient, I'm going to take a nucleus from one of the skin cells and transfer it to an egg. And as you said, it probably would take, using this technique, at least one egg per patient, and as we all know, because this is such an exceedingly inefficient procedure,
right.
probably multiple eggs.
Okay, now in fact, that's what was involved in the South Korean experiments so far. That's how the breakthrough individualized stem cells, regardless of, as we've just discussed, how essential they're going to be to the end process, that's what was used in those experiments and to get those results, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and there were issues from the beginning. Tell us, if you knew anything that wasn't just in the general media, about the question of whether Dr. Huang had used eggs from his employees, from the staff at where the South Koreans were industriously working on this, and what the ethical issues would be about doing that in the U.S. and what they seem to have been in South Korea, and what Dr. Shatton knew and when he knew it, and how that's all being played out now.
All right. So as you know, this situation has got so complex with
right.
so many layers of ethical issues.
More complicated than the science almost, isn't it?
Well, certainly challenging the complexity of the science.
Right.
There's so many different layers, and there are some which have probably a more profound angst, certainly in potential collaborators, than in others.
Right.
So let me first deal not with the potential scientific misconduct
okay.
that of late is being proffered.
Right.
Let's simply talk about what first hit the news maybe about a month ago.
Okay.
And that, you know, admittedly was a complex situation that probably more than anything else to, and I'm going to give it a charitable interpretation.
Okay. Sure.
A charitable interpretation showed a difference in cultures between the Korean culture and the American culture.
Okay.
And I didn't come to this realization just de novo. This was told to me by a number of Koreans who were my postdocs and my trainees with whom I spoke to get some insight into this.
Right.
And also,
Could you go deeper, a little deeper into it? What are the cultures?
Yeah, I will enumerate what was told to me.
Right.
And I also enumerate what was told to me by some representatives of Dr. Wong's lab who came to visit me.
Right.
Probably just before Thanksgiving.
Of this year. Right.
And one is that these concerns initially surrounded the 2004 science paper. And, of course, if one knows if a paper's been published in 2004, it means that the work had to have been done probably back in 2002, maybe 2003.
That was the one before differentiated cells. This was just human cloning for the first time.
Just being able to show that one could really do nuclear transfer, and that was still very inefficient.
Right.
Though maybe, but you know, not
as inefficient as
pretty inefficient. I think it was like one per every 248, something like that.
Right.
Now, what they told me was that at the time, and you have to remember, what was the climate back in 2002? What was written? What was out there?
Right.
They said that prior to beginning these experiments, they sought everything that was ever written about egg donation and about experimentation and things like that. And that this was before any guidelines came out of the National Academy of Science or any of the heavy-duty writing that was being done. And they, believed that they had set up parameters that were in accordance with what the state of the art was back in 2002 and what was written.
Right.
The second thing that they pointed out to me was that while here in the United States we have this notion of the hierarchical arrangement in the workplace and how there shouldn't even be this sense of coercion.
Right.
The notion of coercion doesn't exist in academia in Korea.
Is that because it doesn't happen or because the social psychological mindset is such that that's not an operative concept?
Right, it's the latter.
Okay.
That it's considered such a privilege to be able to work in the laboratory of an esteemed full professor, and that what you're doing is so important to serving the country, serving the culture, serving the principal investigator, that it is considered your privilege. You don't feel coercion. You actually feel the other. You feel as if you want to somehow contribute.
Right.
And that, in fact, they had initially volunteered to donate eggs, and Dr. Wong denied them and said, you can't do this. And then they went behind his back, used pseudonyms, and donated anyway.
Well, they really must have felt a sense of privilege then.
Well, they felt a sense of privilege and a sense of pride.
Right.
The other aspect, and this is what they said.
And be specific then about what the they are.
These are people who are working in the laboratory.
Right, okay.
They consider
and naturally, obviously, all women.
Well, women and men, but obviously only the women would be the ones to be able to donate. And they considered it a privilege to be part of such an important enterprise. And then they said to me that they considered themselves to be pioneers in the same way some of the earliest scientific and medical breakthroughs in the century were done by experimenters experimenting on themselves.
Right.
And if you think about it, the Nobel Prize just a few months ago was awarded to scientists who gave themselves ulcers by swallowing H. pylori.
Right.
So we just gave a Nobel Prize just this year to people that experimented on themselves.
If I'm not mistaken, Dr. Salk and probably Dr. Sabin first applied their polio vaccines to themselves, didn't they?
I don't know about that, but I do know that Children's Hospital in Boston, where I'm from, some of the earliest uses of gamma globulin, some of the earliest uses of many things were the experimenters trying it on themselves.
Is that the same question, though, the self-experimentation?
Well, that's the way, you know, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, that's how they viewed it.
Okay. Right.
So,
essentially, in a long tradition of self-experimentation that, in fact, has been, as you just mentioned, has been validated by the Nobel Prize in Medicine, for example.
Right. So, one does not subject a stranger to any of this. You keep it within your own experimental group. So that was the spirit in which they did it. The second thing that came out was that, so some of this was actually supposedly hidden from Dr. Wong when he found out about it, which he ultimately did find out because, again, an interesting cultural difference was that when it became known by some of these women's peers that they had participated in this.
You mean their fellow technicians?
Right. One of the women was told that if this ever came out, she would never get married. Nobody would ever marry her, and she would never be allowed, and they would never have children with her.
Right.
So she became very upset. Another was told that if this ever became known, that her scientific career was completely finished.
Now, how does that jive with the privilege self-perception of all this? It sounds
I think that took them by surprise. So then they went to Dr. Wong. And this is what I was told, that they went to Dr. Wong and confided in them and then broke their silence and said that we had actually done this, and they pledged him to confidentiality, to patient confidentiality.
Okay.
And in the culture, when you may, you know, pledging confidentiality to somebody certainly takes precedence over being a whistleblower.
So at this point, then the lab technicians had approached Dr. Wang and asked to make the donations. He had refused them. They had done it anonymously and clandestinely.
Right.
The experiment had then been performed successfully before their colleagues started raising their anxiety level?
I believe that, you know, I don't remember the precise chronology, but it seemed that his awareness of this came probably after publication of the paper.
Right.
But
okay, and at that point, the colleagues of the donors had made them anxious enough that they went to Dr. Huang, and he then said he would maintain the confidentiality of that fact to them, and his loyalty or duty was to them to not tell anybody about it.
Well, they pledged him to some confidentiality, to patient, you know, in this country we would call it patient confidentiality. They pledged him to that, or to privilege.
Right.
Now, I think he, you know, so...
And is that when Dr. Shatton asked him what's up, and he said, no, it's okay, based on his confidentiality pledge to the donors?
Well, the rest now becomes my own speculation, because I haven't had a chance to talk with Jerry about this, but I believe, in fact, that probably, that Dr. Wong probably really did keep this all to himself, including when Dr. Shatton then joined him subsequently for some of the work in the 2005 paper.
Right.
They became very close friends, and the way I've surmised the chronology is that creation of the stem cell hub, which was meant to be a worldwide collaboration, certainly an American-Korean collaboration, started taking on a real momentum shortly during the summer of 2005 and proceeding into the fall. And then to the extent that even some of Dr. Wong's technicians had now become part of Dr. Shatton's lab in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
What I surmised happened is that somehow, somebody spilled the beans.
Or perhaps they became acculturated enough to the American system that they started having questions about their Korean values in this particular case.
Yeah, that'll be pure speculation,
but
somehow Dr. Shatton heard or found out that, in fact, that some employees or some technicians or members of the group in Dr. Wong's group had actually been the egg donors.
Were any of those people who had been, traded, transferred on loan to the American enterprise in Pittsburgh?
I don't know that for a fact, but I think so.
Okay.
But again, you know, I actually don't know that.
Okay.
But I think that it may have been that somebody either one of the donors themselves or somebody who's very familiar with the situation.
Right.
Probably within conversation of some sort, this came out.
Now, this is more detailed about this than I've seen or read anywhere else, and I'm wondering whether there is any formal or informal body that's investigating this, whether any of this rises to the level of unethical or even illegal behavior, and whether the National Academy of Sciences or the American Medical Association or any or the World Health Organization, is there any group that has subpoena power or whatever is investigating this, or is this just a matter of speculation and journalistic uncovery and intrigue within the scientific community at this point?
No, I think it's, first of all, what I'd like to emphasize is that for this kind of thing, you know, this has achieved a high level of public awareness.
Right.
But scientists constantly policing themselves in this regard, and by scientists I mean the broad scientific community.
Right.
Not only the scientists themselves, but their oversight committees and the scientific journals themselves.
Right. It seems to me the scientific journals are pretty much the highest authority in this world, aren't they?
Well, you know, we do this all the time about every topic.
Right.
And before you can submit a paper to a journal, for example,
right,
you've got to certify that it's not been published anywhere else,
right,
that you have no conflict of interest, that any animals that were used in an ethical manner.
Right, and of course that all the data you're submitting is the real data that you got.
Right, right, and there's constant policing and oversight. So I think it's important to two things. One, to recognize that all of this came not because one needed congressional committees or laws,
right,
or a czar, but this came from scientists policing themselves and doing what scientists do day in and day out about any data in any field.
Right.
This is just, so what is happening now is, one, the journals themselves are investigating this,
right,
both Nature and Science.
Right.
And the Korean, I don't know if it's the government or the Korean scientific community or Dr. Wang's own university,
right,
is going through investigation. So everything that you just mentioned is now ongoing. And it's taking on a little bit more of an urgency because now, as you know, the events that have started unfolding indicate it's not simply perhaps an interpretation of ethics or maybe particular points in time that may have changed or even cultural differences, there may be some actual problems of scientific misconduct and a miscommunication of the data.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute.
Now that doesn't change from culture to culture.
Right.
That doesn't change from time to time.
That's the global scientific ethic.
This is the ethics that have been part of the scientific rules of conduct for 100 years.
Okay, before we get into that, I wanted to sort of come to some sort of terminus there with the egg issue. When Dr. Shatton became aware of some of these difficulties, what ensued then?
Well, I think what happened was that at a number of levels, I think Dr. Shatton, I think personally, felt so stung that an individual with whom he had developed a personal relationship should have misled him.
Right.
So I think he had a personal reaction. I think he also had a professional reaction,
right,
was that this work is not at the level of my standard of conduct.
Right.
And I must terminate this because I do not condone this, and I can't, and I don't want to in any way be associated with it.
Let me ask you about this. I've seen in other places that Dr. Shatton is the recipient of a lot of NIH money for primate cloning research. Is that right?
You know, I don't. I believe so, but I actually don't know that.
Is there any issue in your mind that he wanted to make sure that he was both factually and perceptually pure in order to avoid any trouble with his funding sources in the U.S. government?
I think he wanted to make sure that he was untainted because a scientist's reputation is all he really has.
Right, okay.
And I don't think it had anything to do with funding. Knowing Jerry, I think it really was that he needed to make sure that his reputation was unbesmirched.
Okay, and then what did he do, and what was the implication of that for the stem cell hub with which he was planning to collaborate with Dr. Huang?
Well, I think given that the stem cell hub was meant to be a collaboration between Dr. Wong, Dr. Shatton, and then, you know, a circle of collaborators to be determined,
right.
It threw the entire enterprise into a state of uncertainty.
Are the South Koreans planning on carrying on their own, do you know?
Well, you know, I think at this point there are so, you know, I think had the situation stopped at that particular point,
right.
Then I think there would have been discussions and meetings and probably a drawing up agreed upon rules of conduct for going forward,
right.
and essentially the ground rules of any kind of collaboration.
Okay, but now, while that was all pending, tell us what has just happened in the last few days in terms of what you were talking about, the unaltered globally understood principles of scientific research and reporting that may or may not have been violated here.
Well, I think now, this happens so often, not just in science, but in any kind of, problem in any area of life, you know, where there's a potential scandal.
Right.
Once you see a little bit of a rent in the material, it gets bigger and bigger as people start sticking their nose in to explore more and more, and I think...
It's like pulling a thread out of a piece of cloth, yes, essentially.
And I think... What happened was that actually in Dr. Shatton's initial letter to the collaborators, and that ultimately became a press release,
right.
The focus principally was on the source of the eggs, but he also indicated in there that there seemed to be some error with one of the tables reporting the data.
Specifically what table reporting what?
There were tables in the paper that talked about the number of cell lines that were made and how... a particular scientific attribute was proven for each one of these, and it's a very technical point.
But essentially, was it similarity to the source cell?
No, this was even before all of that.
Oh, okay.
This was simply that there's many ways of proving that you have a cell line that is what we call pluripotent.
Right.
In other words, it can give rise to many different kinds of cells.
Right.
There are a number of little tests that one does, and it looked as if not all the cell lines had all the tests, and there was a table indicating which cell lines were subjected to which test.
So these were the tests for pluripotency.
Pluripotency, right. And some of it involves making something called a teratoma in a mouse.
Right.
Some of it involves simply looking at what kind of cells you get in a tissue culture dish.
Right.
And
so not all of the tests to prove pluripotency were done?
On all of the lines.
On all of the lines.
Some of them had both, some of them had one, or some of them had the other.
Okay.
And it looked as if, at the time, and Dr. Shatton indicated that he thought that maybe the table that actually got published had some errors in it, but he ascribed it to a transcription error.
Right.
And corrected it. But then I think, again...
And in fact, he corrected it. It's very interesting because I was just listening to a discussion on NPR about the New Testament texts and mm-hmm. how they were changed and corrected and various things that crept in or crept out. Again,
yeah,
it's almost the same thing here, the text of the stem cell testament here. And you're saying that Dr. Shatton, who's made one of his major contributions to this whole process, was to prepare Dr. Huang's research for publication, right?
Right.
And when he did that, you're saying he looked at the data and he said this isn't exactly clear, and he made changes from the raw material that he had, and that's what was published. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, it's probably not even that insidious.
Okay.
I think that he thought that, and this often happens, that what actually appeared in the journal as a printed table,
right.
looked a little bit different than what he submitted to the journal to publish.
So whatever slip was between his submission and their publication.
Right. So, again, it's the kind of thing that could be not an egregious error or not even an intentional error, but just sometimes something that can happen in transcription.
Right.
But needs to be pointed out.
Go ahead.
But then, you know, again, once you see that, then other people start investigating more and more, and then new questions came up, and there was the next bit of concern came that there were pictures in one part of the paper that seemed to be identical to pictures in another part of the paper.
But they were labeled as something different?
But labeled as something different. And
well, with digital, were they digital photographs?
Almost everything is done digitally.
Okay, so if they were the same, they were really the same.
Well, and then the explanation, and again, another fairly innocuous explanation was, and this came from the science editors themselves,
right,
was that to actually publish, you need a higher resolution picture.
Right.
So very often the journal will say, this was good enough for sending it out to reviewers, but
right,
for the actual publication, can you send us as high a resolution picture as possible so
right,
that it doesn't look so pixelated in the journal?
This is publication in online or on paper?
On paper.
Okay.
On paper. And, and Dr. Shatton sent in a higher resolution picture, and somehow that higher resolution picture got mislabeled.
Okay.
Again, a fairly, innocuous explanation of something that tends to often happen, in going from manuscript to a published work.
Right.
But, then the next thing that seemed to come out was that some of the gels, in other words, some of the examination of the DNA to show that the donor of the nucleus and that the cell line were really identical,
right,
looked too good. That they almost, in here's now when you start getting in here,
right,
this is where the specter of scientific misconduct starts rearing its head.
Now, the gels are the things we sometimes see on forensic procedural shows,
right,
showing the matches
or anything. In this kind
markers
of study, you can do anything to show anything you want in the DNA by simply what you probe for.
And what you're saying is that what was expressed there looked too perfect compared to the run-of-the-mill tests that established the identity of the donor and recipient.
Well,
the donor and the final cell, the matching.
The identity between them looked too good. There was not even the normal kinds of variation
right
that you would see between the same gel being run at two separate times by
right
two separate people or something
right
like that. So that raised the specter that maybe it was not really two separate DNA gels being run, but actually somebody using the same gel and simply calling it two separate things. Then there were
two tests. It was the same test.
Labeled
yes, before and after. Or
right. Okay. So now this starts falling into under the rubric of fabrication.
Right.
Now we've crossed the threshold. So everything up until this point, one can talk about plausible deniability, human error that
procedural
is within
error.
Within the noise of just preparing a publication.
Right.
Differences in interpretation of ethics, culture, time. But once you cross the line and you start saying, well, this is an intentional fabrication, you've crossed your Rubicon there.
And the importance of that, whether it was fabricated or not, is that that's essentially it's like putting the acid in the gold and it doesn't dissolve. It's the
right
test to show
right
that this is, that you've got what you say you've got.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, what was the format or the platform in which Dr. Shatton presented this claim of or comment about the possible fabrication here?
Now, this is starting to come from a number of areas now. So
right,
last week, my understanding was that there was actually now a Korean TV crew that is now doing its own journalistic investigation. Just the way 60 Minutes might do an investigation in this country.
And that's something of a cultural breakthrough in Korea, isn't it?
Well, I'm not an expert on
right
Korean culture, but I would imagine that it's probably something
that hasn't been done.
Something new. It's
right
probably not routine for
right
Korean TV.
Right.
On
precisely this point, or the whole, all the questions, or what?
Well, I think they started talking about these DNA gels looking a little too good.
Right.
I think they also, some people started playing with whether some of the photographs really may have been the exact same cells, just
right
presented in different ways to throw people off.
Right.
And before you know it, you have a number of accusations, and I think culminating in, you know, in Dr. Shatton indicating, I think, as we heard today, that he really not only wants to distance himself from these investigators, he wants his name actually removed from the paper.
Right. So, so he's made that. He's communicated that to Science.
Yes, he's communicated that to Science, and I think that
he wants off. He wants off the paper.
He wants to. He does not want to be associated with this work because he can no longer, he says, vouch for its validity.
Now, has he gone a step beyond that and said he thinks it's been fabricated and he wants an investigation? Has anyone called for that, or is the investigation taking place just as a result of his saying he doesn't want to be associated with it anymore?
Yeah, the investigation, when anything like this happens, the journals themselves immediately begin investigating.
How unusual is this?
As do the universities themselves.
How unusual is this in the contemporary history of science?
Well, unfortunately, it's not that so let me qualify that and say it's exceedingly rare, but not so uncommon that NIH, for example, doesn't have an Office of Scientific Misconduct in place.
Right, okay, right.
So, I mean,
and procedures for investigating it.
Oh, absolutely. So every university has an Office of Scientific Integrity. Every investigator
is
mandated
just
by NIH
to
take courses in the proper scientific conduct of science.
Does all that extend to South Korea, or are they under a different system there?
I can't comment on that.
Okay, but in the U.S.
But my understanding, quite frankly, is that that all these present events notwithstanding, that they actually, you know, have fairly rigid requirements for scientific conduct as well.
Okay, so what's the status then of the investigation, if we can call it that? Essentially, Science Magazine is looking into that. Have they sent interrogatories to Dr. Huang and asked him to present evidence or take a deposition?
For this kind of thing, it wouldn't be, I mean, it may involve the more TV-like investigations that we tend to see, but right now, what it probably involves is actually looking at the data.
And who's doing that looking? And is the raw? And where is the raw? Who has access to the raw evidence of the readings of the gels? So who has the gels to reread them?
Or even more telling would be the actual original DNA. And I think that that's probably in Dr. Wong's lab. It's probably being looked at by his own university, and most recently there's going to be a letter coming out in Science from some investigators who themselves have done cloning of various types, saying that the best way to vindicate the data is to have uninvolved scientists independently run the gels.
How about replicating the experiment, which hasn't been done anywhere else yet? Why isn't or hasn't that been done?
Well, you know, the actual experiment, certainly everybody wants to replicate that experiment, except that it really takes that can't happen quickly, and it really takes a huge technical, a great deal of technical expertise. Certainly people will want to do that, and, the issue is never whether this is feasible. I think everybody knew that this was probably feasible, but these guys were the first apparently, to actually successfully do it.
Well, let me ask you then that crucial question. Does this call into question in your mind whether it's they actually did do it?
Well, I think that, you know, the most the most horrible interpretation would be that everything was fabricated. But I think most people are willing to say that because this is a theoretical possibility that one can do this, that it wasn't a biological obstacle, it was more a technical obstacle to be able to do it, that it probably was done. Now, whether it was done as efficiently and done as robustly and done as often as they claim, that may be left to question.
However,
it could be that it is still feasible, but these guys did not do it,
Right.
That would be the ultimate interpretation.
Okay.
The thing is moving so quickly that my belief is that people, scientists don't do things in a hysterical manner.
Right.
The nature of science is you do it in a measured, thoughtful, step-by-step manner, and you simply reproduce the data, maybe even at the exact same pace in which it was generated to begin with.
So does that mean people are back to cell one here, back to square one?
Yeah, I think it'll be reproducing in their own labs, if possible, you know, what's been done, which is what anybody wants to do anyway.
Right. Nobody
wants to acknowledge a monopoly, yield a monopoly to somebody else on any kind of scientific technique.
Are these guys going to get an asterisk by their record here?
I think only, well, it won't be quite like the Roger Maris asterisk,
okay.
But it'll be,
like,
you know,
the steroid asterisk.
I think what we need to do is, you know, simply say the jury is out until literally the data is either validated or invalidated, and then quite frankly, any scientific discovery, even the most carefully done, untainted study, is not valid until it can be reproduced by another lab independently.
You don't think that this is likely in the public perception or the scientific community's perception to put achievement in the zone of cold fusion, do you?
No, it's not going to fall into cold fusion, because with cold fusion, you know, as you recall back then, they were doing something that every bit of scientific knowledge indicated was impossible to do, and in fact it was impossible.
But their results showed more heat out than heat in.
Yeah, but this is not considered to be impossible.
Okay.
This is considered to be quite feasible.
But difficult.
Just very difficult.
And okay. So that pretty much brings things up to date on what's going on in South Korea and Pittsburgh then, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, as far as we know, though, as you can tell, it changes literally day to day.
Okay. Well, you've been very generous with your time so far, and I guess maybe to round out the hour here, what I'd like you to do, if you can, is talk about what the implications of all of this, the egg issues and the fabric, the allegedly possibly fabricated issue, and what this means for the future of stem cell research, particularly in California, in your institute, and under the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee and the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which was authorized to spend $3 billion to do this kind of research, but that's been held up through various legal difficulties. What does this mean? Does this reposition what's potentially going to happen in California, or hasn't happened, or needs to happen, according to some? What's the impact on California stem cell research of all this?
Well, I think, you know, I think on one level, I think it actually, contrary to way to the way in which some people may interpret this, this was an example of scientists really policing themselves pretty aggressively.
So it's pretty much a bad news, good news kind of thing.
Right, so I mean, it is not good when somebody violates the rules of science. On the other hand, you can see what happens when scientists themselves police themselves and decide that a member of their own community, you know, is not playing by the rules.
Although, based on what you said, it was essentially the informal conversations of some of the South Korean technicians who had gone to Pittsburgh and were maybe culture shock led them to say one thing or another to each other and then to Dr. Shatton, and that was the first glimpse of this thread that's been unraveling. And
well,
absent that, we might not be having this conversation at all.
Well, that's not exactly true.
Okay.
You know, Nature a year ago,
right,
had done their own investigation.
Okay.
And a journalist named Peter Aldiss had started investigating this at Nature and came up with a lot of the facts that were actually back then denied.
Okay. Oh, okay. So what you're saying is that the essential machinery of the scientific community and not just serendipitous behavior
is responsible for
seeing that this is under more scrutiny now. Okay.
Oh, no. It had constantly been in place. Plus, even if one does not talk about scientific misconduct, sometimes bad data can get into the literature, not because of malicious intent, but simply because somebody makes a genuine error. Now, I'm not talking about a transcription error or a typo. I'm talking about somebody not recognizing that a certain molecule does this or that.
Right.
And it it gave the appearance of one result and the other was actually the result. Sometimes it's just the evolution of knowledge. And there's the scientific field is filled with one interpretation, a legitimate, honest interpretation being overturned by somebody else finding something else that showed that maybe that was an artifact. The scientist was fooled.
Right.
So that happens constantly. So there's always a constant reinterpretation of every bit of scientific data, including what Dr. Wong would have done.
Okay. What I saw when the South Koreans did this was that these were things that American or California scientists had been hoping to do, either on their own or with money that they got from Prop 71.
Right.
And when the South Koreans did it, I thought, well, okay, they get bragging rights, if nothing else, and maybe they get intellectual property rights. And now this means that, on the one hand, California scientists won't be able to get that breakthrough, but on the other hand, they'll be able to move forward on the basis of that breakthrough and do more things. But apparently, as you were saying, just even the negotiations for sharing of the technology or the procedures, which now seem to be in some question as to their validity, hasn't happened. Does this mean that the race is on? Essentially, the race is on again, and that California scientists or British scientists or people in Singapore or wherever can make this breakthrough again and have it be more substantially verified?
Possibly. I mean, if for some reason everything that the Koreans reported turned out to be fallacious, then
right.
Obviously, you know, we can start, from scratch and the race is on again.
Okay.
I think what most likely is the case that they probably did achieve this. They probably didn't achieve it with the efficiency that they claimed, but now we're not also going to be able to rely on them to be our partners in doing this, and we're going to have to kind of duplicate that technology here in our own backyards or partner with other people that are closer to getting the technology done.
Okay.
So it slows us up.
All right. Good. I think that's the bottom line for now, and I want to thank you for leading us to it and explaining everything up to it, and I hope we can talk some more as this fast-moving field continues to move fast.
Well, thanks for contacting me.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.